Hello, everyone. Welcome to your newest episode of the Cosmic Matrix podcast with your host, myself, Laura Matsu, and my husband, Bernhard Günther. And on this episode, we are going to discuss how we can face cancel culture with courage. So this current climate of cancel culture, we've heard it from many people we speak to. We've seen it in ourselves. It's really affecting people's lives and mental health in all sorts of detrimental ways. People are afraid to have conversations with other people. They're scared of sharing their opinions in fear that someone or some group of people will decide that their opinions are problematic, or in 1984 speak they're a thought crime. And they'll basically go on a campaign to ruin their lives. So in essence, cancel culture is this form of social ostracization. People lose jobs, they lose friends, they can lose their business, all because a group of people have decided to disapprove of them or decides that they're offensive. And canceling is when a group of people target a person, especially through public shaming, in response to either a real or perceived harm they believe the person has caused. And the people who find themselves at the center of these cancel storms and this mob justice often report feelings of anxiety, depression, a sense of social isolation. And it also has a very profound effect on bystanders who are watching that person being canceled. Because after seeing so many people be canceled, many bystanders will also begin to experience anxiety themselves, afraid that they're going to get canceled too if they say something that others disagree with, which causes many to censor themselves, which then also causes extra anxiety in itself. So many people live in fear of expressing themselves in this climate for fear that everything they say will be examined under a microscope and potentially construed as offensive, even if it wasn't meant to be. And we see this canceling everywhere. It most often accompanies social justice campaigns. So cancel culture first came into public awareness around 2017. It coincided with the Me Too movement. So this cancel culture was a reaction to the unresponsiveness of institutions in regards to the influx of sexual abuse that was being reported. And canceling was basically a form of taking power back from people who felt disillusioned with that system. But now, people are being canceled for tweets they made years ago, which are then being perceived as racist. They're being canceled for having opinions that go against this current status quo. People got canceled en masse for speaking out against the vaccine. They got canceled and told they were white supremacists if they didn't support BLM and then become anti-racist and apologize for their privilege. And most recently, what we see now on social media is that people are being canceled if they are being perceived to not have spoken out enough against about the Palestinian people and the Palestine and Israel conflict. And we really want to stress that canceling and cancel culture creates a social environment of fear. And that's kind of the intention of it. It's also a primary tool of cultural Marxism. So in this podcast, we are going to discuss the emergence of cancel culture, why people who support cancel culture think it's a good thing, how canceling links in with this idea of cultural Marxism. We're going to define what cultural Marxism is, how cultural Marxism and the cancel culture has characteristics of Mao's struggle sessions in the 1960s Cultural Revolution. And what the link is with cancel culture around Palestine, how it links to the issue with BLM, the issue of mobs, of social justice warriors and mob rule. And most importantly, since we get this question a lot, like from people asking us, how can I speak out? I really have things to say. It's really, you know, starting to gnaw on me that I'm not really being authentic. We want to give you some practical tips based on our own direct experience and based on some other teachers, how you can face cancel culture with courage. And in the second hour, for those who are new to our podcast, we always do a second hour where we go much deeper. You can join us at veilofreality.com/membership, and you'll also get access to 120 plus hours of podcasts that we've recorded. We're going to explore this issue from a more esoteric occult perspective. We're going to talk about how cancel culture links into ideologies and totalitarianism. We're going to tie it into the concept of Wetiko, occult forces, entity possession, thought form, hive mind entities, and egregores. We're going to share personal stories about being canceled. And we're also going to talk about how it links into Pluto and Capricorn, this idea of totalitarianism, which is on both sides. How this relates to certain Pluto generations that are coming of age and more. So if you want to listen to that, the second hour, you can always join us by going to veilofreality.com/membership. So yeah, let's just talk about the emergence of cancel culture.
Yeah. So thank you for this great introduction. It's still going on, obviously, especially the one of the main reasons we want to do this podcast, because we see the emergence of this or intensifying cancel culture through the recent Israel-Palestine conflict, where people are being canceled for not speaking out enough about pro-Palestine, all of that. By the way, we have a whole episode on the occult forces significance of the Israel-Palestine conflict last year. You can check out that podcast where we go deeper into all of that and the issue of polarization and the black and white thinking and all of that.
But most importantly, one thing that we highlighted actually, which we're going to go into much deeper in this podcast, is number one, how Wetiko, which we saw work through BLM, you know, take a knee, you need to put up a fist and say Black Lives Matter, is working in the same way through this issue now. And the issue, it's not actually about the issue anymore. It's actually being used as a Trojan horse to gain more control. And it's going to be a tool of cultural Marxism, which we pointed out because we saw back then in that podcast that people were using these kind of woke buzzwords like decolonization, which doesn't actually mean what people think it literally means in the context. So we're going to talk about all of that.
Exactly. In a nutshell, what that means, that this protest, this conflict, and even the atrocities and everything what's happening in the Middle East conflict there between Israel and Palestine has been hijacked by the woke left neo-Marxists. And it ties into saying what Karl Marx literally wrote in the Communist Handbook, that the issue is never the issue, but the issue is revolution, meaning they use any conflict, whatever they care. They don't really, quote-unquote, care about the conflict itself, but whatever they can use to create more chaos, to destabilize society and all of that. So we'll talk more about this shortly.
Yeah.
But going back to the quote-unquote beginning, like you mentioned, truly it started around 2017, more to the forefront of the Me Too movement. But even before that, the emergence of the so-called cancel culture. And it's really fascinating because recently we've been listening to an audio podcast series called The Witch Hunt of J.K. Rowling. Is that the correct title?
J.K.
Rowling, obviously the author of Harry Potter. And I don't know if you follow her on Twitter, but she's getting recently canceled by the woke left, right? Because she has the audacity to make a statement that a biological man is a biological man, right? So it's really fascinating, this series. I can highly recommend it to listen to it because it's also fascinating. I didn't even know that J.K. Rowling got canceled and attacked by the right Christian dogmatic fundamentalist movement, the far right, and now is getting canceled by the far woke left. So she's getting canceled by both sides. So she must be doing something, right? But in this series, it was interesting. They kind of did a little, it's great research. And this, the emergence of the cancel culture really started in the early 2000s on a platform called Tumblr. And Tumblr is pretty big. What is it, in the millennial or generation, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
More leftist movements. And there was a threat started literally by a high school student called
Your fave is problematic.
Your fave is problematic. Fave meaning your favorite?
Your favorite actor, actress, celebrity, etc.
Exactly. Where even the word problematic is already this woke language, where this person was quote unquote exposing celebrities for having problematic views, offensive views, right? And all of that, digging up what they said or even all the tweets. And this then was carried on or taken to Twitter, and it blew up on Twitter because Twitter has the big accounts, even big media companies, journalists, who then used just basically to generate readership, because outrage porn is always attracts readership, right? Use these threats or these claims of problematic views and blew them up to the point that then celebrities felt forced to apologize, right? To own it, to you just need to apologize. Oh, I'm sorry, I said this X years ago. And then that's when the whole wave started of people digging up old tweets from whatever people said 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And these targeted individuals, the mostly famous people, celebrities, were experiencing the mob cult getting on them on Twitter and in other ways and calling them out. You need to apologize, you know, we're holding yourself, you need to hold yourself accountable and all of that. And that's really where it started. It's really fascinating, from Tumblr to Twitter. And then it took a life on its own.
Yeah. And the most important thing, and this is also going to be how it links in with Mao's cultural revolution, is that a niche happening on Tumblr then got co-opted and picked up by the mainstream media and then made into this bigger issue.
Yeah.
You know, so that's kind of how it reached the forefront. So, you know, and what people who are pro-cancel culture have to say about it is that they're being held accountable. So that cancel culture allows individuals and businesses to be held accountable for their actions. And they're not able to escape their misdeeds because they're being publicly canceled and publicly shamed. But to see, and, you know, accountability is a tricky word, because who are you being accountable and whose values are you being accountable for? So, yeah, you know, you're being held accountable to the values of these social justice warriors. Like, for example, you know, people said that we were transphobic for interviewing Leighton on a recent podcast about her experience detransitioning. And so in their eyes, they were just holding us accountable. But yeah, we were just talking to Leighton about her experience detransitioning with trauma and spirit attachments, because it really ties into our work. And I found her story to be very fascinating. So the issue with accountability is that you're being held accountable to someone else's ideology, to
yes,
someone else's standards, not to your own values, you know. Like, if I cheat on my husband, for example, and he gets upset at me, you know, like, it's actually him getting upset at me is not his job to hold me accountable. It's up to me to hold myself accountable for that.
Yes.
Him getting upset at me can maybe mirror to me, oh, I did something wrong, you know, but it's not other people's job to force their values on you and hold you accountable for something that isn't your value to begin with. So yeah,
you see this distortion and abuse of the word accountability all across the board, not only in the woke left. You see it in the spiritual movement. Oh, you need to hold this guy accountable and this and that. And the mob move, you know, this outrage porn we see in, you know, in certain communities and cults and all of that, which is fine and good. Some of them need to expose, but people never look at the people who joined any quote unquote questionable cult when there were the red flags all over, for example. So accountability, like you rightly said, is highly distorted. And I want to just throw in another quick example. I know this guy on Facebook some couple of years ago when Trump was in power, you know, he is not really politically active, more into spiritual, you know, movement, kind of new age a little bit. But he posted a quote about Trump, which is true in itself. Then, but, you know, and all of a sudden he got mobbed by his, quote, friends and community, you know, to take it down and apologize. This is wrong. This is Trump, all the TDS people, to the point that he felt pressured, literally took the post down the next day and thanked his community for holding him accountable.
Yeah, so he was being held accountable to someone else's values just for
exactly
posting something that was
actually true, but yeah, people had TDS and hated Trump and like, oh, you cannot do this, you know, and then, oh, thank you, no, I can't do this, so that he gave in to the mob.
Yeah. So let's really go into why canceling is a primary tool of cultural Marxism, and we're going to break it down step by step. So let's first just define cultural Marxism and how it relates to what we see happening today, and then we'll talk about how it connects with what's going on right now.
Okay. So here's obviously the great James Lindsay has an excellent in-depth definition of cultural Marxism, and quoting him here now. The most apt meaning of cultural Marxism is that the underlying oppressor versus oppressed analytic dynamic utilized in Marxism proper is reappropriated out of the economic context and into the cultural context. So just to decode this, so Marxism, you know, original Marxism was based on economics, poor and rich and whatnot, but it's also applied out of the economic context into the cultural context of perceived oppressor versus perceived oppressed.
This is where you get the terms like white privilege, etc.
Decolonization and all of
yes
that. And he continues, in many regards, this application of Marxian conflict theory to cultural phenomena is in fact what neo-Marxism is about, and is also what critical social justice is about. So cultural Marxism is basically a mixture of neo-Marxism and cultural social justice. If in the latter case, one reduces cultures to a sense of solidarity with and shared values and political aims with one's identity groups, say like race, sex, gender, or sexuality.
Otherwise known as identity politics. So when you're being told to apologize because you're a cis, white, able-bodied person, that is identity.
What is able-bodied?
Able-bodied means you're not disabled. Now you have to indicate that as part of like apologizing. But so any of the things, issues around race, around sex, around gender, which brings in the trans movement, sexuality, it's all falls under the same bucket. And, you know, James Lindsay has an excellent talk about it. I've posted it before. Just continue.
Yeah, he continues. A related meaning that is also not completely wrong and is characteristic of both movements, neo-Marxism and critical social justice, is the belief that the socioeconomic goals of Marxism, i.e. socialism and or communism, can in the end be achieved through cultural means and agitations.
Yes.
So this is a very key point, the last sentence, that through the oppressor versus oppressed, all what we see out there, what people speak out, BLM, Palestine, Israel, and trans, all of that, trans and racism, sex, gender, they're being used, these cultural means, and purposely agitated using this conflict in order to bring in communism, Marxism, socialism. And a lot of these people who engage in that, we'll talk about this later on, just become literally useful idiots in an agenda they have no awareness of.
Yeah. And, you know, James Lindsay has a very interesting talk about it where he ties how what's going on now with the whole kind of woke ideology is Marxism with Maoist characteristics is what he calls it. And he really relates, and it's actually scary if you watch videos about Mao's Cultural Revolution and you see how it links in with cancel culture today, because it's literally, it seems like they're playing from the same playbook. Yeah. So the Cultural Revolution happened in China in the 60s, and in a nutshell, the Cultural Revolution was launched by Mao Zedong in 1966 and lasted until his death in 1976. And its stated goal was to preserve Chinese communism by purging remnants of capitalist and traditional elements from Chinese society. So they wanted to burn old books. They wanted to get rid of old buildings, anything that linked them to the past, which is actually the conservative aspect of China, needed to be eliminated.
Destroy statues, all of that.
Yeah. And what's interesting is, you know, Mao is known for having what's called the Red Guards. So the Red Guards were, in essence, mobs of people that weren't like hired by the government. They were just mobs of people who were enforcers of Mao's policies, who he allowed to exist so that they could further his agenda. At the same time, he never wanted them to get too powerful and overtake him. So, you know, keep in mind that these mobs of social justice warriors, for example, are only going to be useful to the current administration or deep state or whatever you want to call it until they're no longer useful. And then they're going to also be treated the same way as people who speak out.
And also important to note, you know, again, that's why it would be very good to understand the Cultural Revolution in China, what happened, the Maoist, communist, Marxist takeover, because it's so much similar to what's happening right now. The Red Guards were not, like Laura said, just some government state police. It was not like an SS type thing, but they're really comprised of mainly university and high school students, right? No different than what's happening right now.
Yeah, they were a type of mob justice. So, you know, I saw this during BLM and even the vaccine, but I saw it very strongly during BLM. I don't even know exactly what I wrote, but there was periods where I would get mobs of literally hundreds of people descending onto my profiles, like leaving like laughing emojis or angry, you know, like trying to just like, or if my comments were open. That's, by the way, I have protected comments on my profile because I've dealt with this so much. And, you know, the Red Guards of Mao's Cultural Revolution, they would look for leaked documents that exposed information about people who were not loyal to the party. They investigated teachers and artists, and they looked for any evidence they could to find that someone said something in the past or present that would indicate that, in their words, they were a cult counter-revolutionary or revisionist or rightist. And, you know, you could call basically these terms anything you want, but they're meant to be vague on purpose.
Yes.
You know, same as like, you need to apologize for your privilege. Like, well, what privilege, you know, and why do I need to apologize for that? Or I've been told I need to apologize for slavery, even though my ancestors didn't own slaves. So it's always this vague accusation, you know, that's kind of a blanket one based on your own identity group that you need to apologize for. And that's what the mob justice is about.
And through intimidation and the mob psychology and all of that, people do apologize for something they should never apologize because, to begin with.
Exactly. Because the social pressure, the social pressure is a lot. Like, they use this idea, like, you know, a lot of human beings want to just belong. They want to be accepted. And so they can use this social pressure to exert you, to make you do things that you don't want to do. So basically, the social justice warriors are our versions of Mao's Red Guards, and canceling people is our version of Mao's struggle sessions.
Yes.
So while the Red Guards would look for any evidence that a person was a counter-revolutionary, social justice warriors are on the hunt for anyone who they deem to be problematic or a colonizer now, or having white privilege. Like, it will change with time. That's why we're trying to point out, it's not about the Palestine and Israel issue. It's not even about BLM or whatever. It just will change and morph with whatever is a popular issue of today. And their goal is basically to exert psychological pressure so that you either stay silent, apologize for the perceived harms that they believe you have caused, and ultimately they want you to show your complete allegiance to the ideologies that they support.
Yeah. What's very important to understand, the psychological pressure of the, so what you mentioned before and right now, towards bystanders, because that's how it really works. And I can see this in a lot of people, we have worked with, people I know or talked in private, that more and more people are actually afraid to have an opinion, to speak out, because they're afraid of getting canceled, of getting attacked, the mob and all of that. So by extension, the issue right now is that people start censoring themselves.
Yeah. And then also one aspect of Mao's Red Guards is the psychological pressure would also be around the people around you. So like, if you won't shut up, they'll get people around you to be like, well, why can't you just apologize? Why can't you just take the tweet down? Why can't you just stop speaking up? You know, so they create this whole culture around you where you're just afraid to express an opinion. So Mao would also, similar to what's happening in the mainstream media, would amplify these findings that the Red Guards would find on the radio and the newspaper, which then inspired more workers to join the Red Guards. So it's expanded beyond just high school and university students, which is what's happening now. A lot of this indoctrination started in the schools, and now it's expanding to, you know, quote unquote, everyday people. And so struggle sessions, which today, now we call cancel culture, were a way that Mao used to gain compliance and to make sure that everyone had the political opinion that they wanted them to have.
The right political opinion.
And it begins with this vague accusation of causing harm, which is very similar to what we see now, where it's like, your privilege is showing, you're a colonizer, you're transphobic.
Your views are harmful to the trans community.
Yeah, exactly. So their goal is to pressure you psychologically to apologize for the harm that they perceive that you have caused, and then admit to it. And I'm not talking about real harm. Like, say, let's take the Me Too example, even though there was also lots of false cases in the Me Too movement, by the way. But say some guy in the Me Too movement actually did sexually abuse someone, was never held accountable. Some woman shared her story, and then everyone knew about it, right? That is a real harm that he caused.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
Weinstein, for example.
Exactly. But a lot of this is happening to perceived harms. Like, for example, what we shared about earlier, we are accused of harming trans people because we talked to a detransitioner about her experience.
Yeah.
Is that a real, like, in their eyes, it's a harm, but then you're being pressured to apologize for things that you may not have even perceived as a harm. And we face this primarily on social media now. It happens in workplace trainings where you see that people have to announce their privilege right off the bat. Like, you know, they have to literally introduce themselves by saying, I'm a white, cisgendered, blah, 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 you know. Diversity, equity, inclusion trainings where you're being called racist, transphobic, white privilege, problematic. So people are consumed by this ideology, therefore make you take accountability for the harm you've done according to their ideology. And let's just talk about how it kind of ties in with the with what we're seeing now and what we saw in the past few years.
Yeah. So, for example, like regarding the BLM, right? People who didn't support BLM throughout the pandemic, past 2-3 years or 3-4 years, they got canceled, right? And then it was the vaccine, very much the same. If you wouldn't support the vaccine, I would say something against it. The mob would come, you're a threat, you're a danger to society, right? You're not getting the vaccine, will get others sick, as completely illogical, didn't even make sense anymore. And now it's very, I see this now rising, and it's very disturbing. I see this more and more now with the issue about the conflict of Palestine versus Israel. And there's literally, there's an almost an organized agenda on social media by some people that go through profiles and attack people or even block people or call them out and cancel them publicly if that person does not speak out for pro-Palestine on their social media account.
Yeah, and
it's insanity. And I just want to like add to this because just for context, and again, we had a whole podcast about the Palestine-Israel conflict from a cold, hidden perspective, from a bigger picture perspective. 2 hours, we go deep into this topic itself. So check that out. And I want to go into this specifically, but I want to just preface this as well. I've mentioned that before. I was a pro-Palestine, hardcore pro-activist 10, 15 years ago, when most of these people who speak out nowadays were still in high school or kindergarten, right? Or even... not even born, maybe. I don't know. I was at protests. I literally had painted the Palestine flag on my face. I saw all the horrific pictures. I also engaged on that on social media, some of that, like showing it, like, you need to speak out about this, bum, bum, bum. But had many other realizations going deep down the rabbit hole with my own process and being even present in many demonstrations physically. There are a lot of issues what I saw with that and don't have that black and white view anymore. That being said, there's definitely atrocities happening in Palestine, and there's also atrocities happening from Hamas towards Israel. I want to go beyond this black and white view. I want to say I have been there. I know that. I'm not blind to it all. But what I see now is how this conflict has been completely hijacked by a neo-Marxist agenda that has handwritten all over Mao's ways of... a cultural revolution, where a conflict like this is just being used to infuse a society, to destroy society or destruct a society, to destabilize, create chaos, and bring in a whole other agenda and bring in all kinds of other issues that have actually nothing to do with the conflict itself. And yes. Like I said, again, a lot of these naive pro-Palestine protests that be on the campuses and even on social media, right? They actually now support an agenda they have no awareness of. They have become useful idiots. And also, out of experience, having been in this game for a long time, nothing is going to change in the Middle East of you just posting a Palestine flag on social media or just speaking out about a social media. If you really want to do change, go to Palestine. I know a couple of people, some friends back in the days, who literally went to Palestine through the tunnels, yeah, through Egypt and helped people right there on the ground. You're not helping them by posting a Palestine flag on your social media. I'm sorry. And besides that, sorry, before I go off on a rant here, you guys know our work. It's also about the inner work to bring about a different frequency, a different consciousness, and see the hidden forces enacting and all of that. But right now, there's a whole different agenda that has taken over this Palestine-Israel conflict and protests around them.
And I highly recommend, you know, New Discourses, which is James Lindsay's website. It has a good, like, woke kind of translation guide where he translates all these words. And a lot of the things that have been centered around Palestine that I've seen with this kind of cultural Marxist kind of weaving together is centered around this idea of decolonization, right? So decolonization actually doesn't mean the literal sense to a lot of these people. It doesn't mean to the withdrawal of colonial powers from a country that it has seized control of and exploited, basically. Decolonization means undoing what people see as the broader effects of colonialism, such as systems of government, law, culture, religion, and language, and recovering prior systems. So in social justice sense, this is, and I'm reading this from New Discourses, if you look up their definition of decolonization, it is used more broadly to basically decolonize anything from science to ways of obtaining knowledge. So its idea is that, you know, even spelling accurately, like making the correct spelling, that's a tool of colonizers to oppress us. You can unpack anything. Math, yeah. Math is colonial. Yeah. Like, you know, so basically people deconstruct this word. And what it essentially means is to remove white or Western influences from literally anything. So decolonizing university curriculum, which means removing Western influences. So if Shakespeare, he's white, we need to decolonize the curriculum and take out people like Shakespeare and put other people in. Yeah. That's essentially what it means. So, you know, and it can even go further to decolonizing hairstyles, like cultural appropriation fits into here.
Oh, so being working out is racist.
Yeah, anything. Yeah. So basically, you know, these cancel mobs, which are centered around decolonizing the world, they're canceling people who they feel aren't speaking up enough. I've seen people I know being included on these lists. And by the way, some people included on these lists have spoken up, but in the mob's view, they haven't done enough. You know, it's a frenzy. It doesn't matter. Yeah. It doesn't have any reason behind it. It's very emotionally and fear driven.
So basically, I also want to just add, all of this then becomes like a Trojan horse for cultural Marxist agenda.
Yes.
Even the Palestine conflict. And I will say there's a certain amount of people, maybe definitely a minority, who are truly neo-Marxists, who know that agenda and work appropriately.
Yeah.
Accordingly, I mean. But the vast majority of people who then repeat these slogans, decolonization and appropriation and accountability, and this is problematic, and this, on, you know, they take on this language of the neo-Marxists, similar, no different what Mao did in the 60s with his students, and they've then taken on, they're not acting out of their own free will. So anybody's doing this is literally running a program like an NPC that's been infected, right, with this ideology and projected externally towards others, and they become by extension like Agent Smiths, unconscious portals for an agenda they have no awareness of. And it ties into more in the occult significance as well from an esoteric occult perspective, Wetiko, egregores, which we'll touch upon deep into the second hour. But I want to be very clear that people who speak out, I see this all over social media, people take on this language, this neo-Marxist woke language, cultural revolutionary language, that is literally just a program they've taken on. It's completely unconscious.
Yeah. So the issue is never the issue. The issue is to create a revolution through creating chaos and destabilization, and the people who, you know, it's going to attach to every issue of the day. It just morphed just in time for election season, by the way, to this Israel-Palestine issue. So it's hijacking people's idealism and compassion. So I'm going to play a clip of James Lindsay explaining this very well. And he's tying in struggle sessions and cancel culture. And he explains this really beautifully in this clip. And it's from the podcast Some Kind of Therapist with Stephanie Nguyen. And it's just a clip from that podcast.
You had said that you wanted to explore the dynamics of struggle sessions. That is something I do have some experience with, including in groups of therapists as well. So I'm curious to start there. How would you define a struggle session, and why is it relevant to psychological warfare?
Well, a struggle session, it is a technique or a term, I should say. The term actually comes from, I don't know how familiar you are with Chinese culture, but the Chinese are very blunt with the way they define things. The reason, for example, that we call brainwashing is because what got translated into English is thought reform, which is a nicer way to put it. It comes from the Chinese words that mean wash brain. And they're just very blunt descriptions of things. And so they actually talked about it when training people to have the right opinions, the right political opinions, they actually called it critical struggle. They didn't call them struggle sessions. They called it struggle. The thing that you go through is struggling with yourself to have the correct political opinions. And it is a psychosocial phenomenon. It is not wholly psychological. It's not as though you're in, you know, Guantanamo in a cell and they just are berating you and put you through all these weird psychological experiences. It is, in fact, creating your social milieu primarily. It is putting you in a situation where you are alleged to have committed some crime. It can be a very vague crime. In fact, it is best if it is a vague crime. For example, harming the Chinese people was a very common one during Mao's reign in the 1950s. Espionage is another one. Passing secrets, just very vague things. Who knows what you could have done that they would have classified this? Of course, the idea is that in that case, it would have been the Chinese government, right? The idea is that they're omniscient, roughly. They know what you did. You don't know what you did, but they want you to confess to what you did. And so it becomes a psychosocial phenomenon in which they're trying to extract a confession to a vague or ill-defined crime that they are trying to train you in their own language to recognize. They're training you to recognize your crimes on a predetermined set of terms. And so how do you harm the Chinese people? Well, they have a certain meaning for who the Chinese people that count as the people are. They have a certain definition for harm, which should, you know, raise all of our eyebrows in the present moment, because that's a very weaponized term. And we hear that word every day now in very kind of peculiar ways. And your goal is to be, their goal is to pressure you psychologically into figuring out on their terms how you harmed other people. And they facilitate this, and it's different in different contexts. We face them primarily on social media now. Although they take place in workplace trainings, DEI trainings in particular, I think at work, the diversity, equity, inclusion, or belonging, they call it sometimes now training, almost always uses this. White fragility as a concept is a struggle session in a box. But in the Chinese prisons, it was a little different because you were in a prison. Part of your experience would be hauled in front of an interrogator or a judge who would tell you, you've committed a crime against the Chinese people, go ahead and confess to it. And, you know, your crime is espionage or harming the Chinese people. What have you done to harm the Chinese people? Just start listing things. By the way, we know everything. And then they tell you whatever you say, whether you resist, whether you go along with it, whatever, that whatever you said was not good enough, and we're going to have to let you go back and think about it. But when you went back to your cell in a Chinese prison, you were not alone in your cell. You were in a cell with roughly 10 people total, plus or minus a handful, 8 to 12 typically in a cell. And that social environment in the cell was very, very, very abusive. And if you didn't participate in the abuse, you fell back to the bottom of the ladder and your process started again. So it wasn't very hard to get the people in the cell to become abusers of the new people in the cell. And what they would do is not only belittle you and yell at you and harass you and not let you sleep and bully you, but what they would consistently do is tell you they were helping you. They were helping you to want to confess. Because when you want to confess, and when you want to confess with sincerity, then what you're going to do is you're going to be able to wrap up this whole affair and we can just get on with it. And so what they're tantalizing you with is a sense of relief when you do it right. So your social milieu is weaponized against you to try to give you the sense that there's this dangled relief that will come when you do what the perpetrator wants you to do. So the person perpetrating the struggle session or the mob maybe perpetrating the struggle session wants you to do something. Maybe it's apologize for something that you said. You said a racism or something like this, but you don't really know why you said a racism. Well, they have to teach you to recognize why what you said is a racism. They have to teach you to recognize your crime. And so they want you to confess to having done it and apologize and promise to do better and commit to activism. These are exactly the things that we see in the diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging training. There are also things that happen routinely on social media. They bully you and call you names and tell you how you're terrible. And they just kind of constantly dangle this idea that it's just better right on the other side. All you have to do is say that you're sorry. All you have to do is apologize and this pressure is going to go away. And meanwhile, it usually takes place where there's just enough ambiguity to where some of your friends want that pressure to go away too. You know what? Just apologize. Just be the bigger person. You know, they have a point. It's reasonable to go ahead and say that you made a mistake. All of these kinds of psychological pressures are coming from your social milieu. Now, they usually affect that social pressure by saying that you are besmirching some group you're involved in. So maybe, you know, I'm in my martial arts club or whatever, and they say, I am making my martial arts club look bad. And the only way that I can make the martial arts club look better is by apologizing. And they start saying this to people. Oh, people who do this martial art are terrible. People who work out at this club are associated with this guy. He's a racist, blah, 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 the whole thing. And so those people start to say, dude, just make it go away. Just say something. Just apologize and make it go away. And so it's this form of psychological torture, really, that's affected through manipulating the social environment around you to create psychological struggle so that you recognize crimes that are ill-defined in reality but are clearly defined on the terms put forth by the perpetrator, so that what you do is sell yourself out and accept the terms of behavior put forth by the perpetrator. And these things are really, really, really psychologically overwhelming if you get put through one, whether it's in person at like a, you know, a kind of a group thing or whatever, like at a DEI training or workplace or whatever, or whether it's online and you get one of these things that have been called Twitter storms or, you know, a pile-on or whatever, where hundreds and hundreds of accounts are all telling you that you messed up in some way and you need to, you know, make amends for it. And what you'll find reliable is your friends start saying, dude, make it go away. Dude, just admit you messed up and move on. Just take some accountability and move on. So it's a weaponization of social accountability to get you to confess to a crime you never committed so that you'll accept the trumped up terms that the alleged crime exists on. And then I think, in other words, it's a mechanism for weaponizing a social environment to get you to sell your soul.
Yeah. Wow. Very well put. And we see this concept of the Chinese struggle sessions, obviously, as he just made a reference, especially towards the end, on social media. You've experienced it, just, he calls about these Twitter storms also on Instagram. I've experienced it in my own way. And recently is now this, talking about this Palestine, Israel question, conflict, and everybody needs to speak out about pro-Palestine, you don't do enough, do it already.
Yeah.
Isn't there now, I think you came across some certain account that calls out for certain profiles to be blocked and canceled because exactly. They don't say anything about Palestine.
Yeah, I've been on that list, even though we did record a 2-hour podcast about it, but they don't care about it, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, this is really the cancel culture that we're dealing with. And, you know, it's not for everyone, as he said in this clip, it is really difficult to be on the end of it. That being said, you know, after I had these kind of Twitter storms or like pile-ons, I've had that a few times, meaning like some popular account shared my post and then like everyone piled on to me, basically. You know, this happens obviously because of my own reach. So most people who are silencing themselves are actually not going to deal with these circumstances. And the main antidote to cancel culture is courage. There's a few things I have to say about this, but for those who are familiar with David Hawkins' map of consciousness, courage is a critical step as far as getting from a state, a contracted state to a more expanded state, or a victimized state to a more empowered state. And, you know, I have a couple quotes actually from Courage before I talk about how David Hawkins says to access courage. But here's a great quote from Osho. The greatest fear in the world is of the opinions of others. And the moment you are unafraid of the crowd, you are no longer a sheep. You become a lion. A great roar arises in your heart, the roar of freedom. And here's another great quote. You can't be truthful if you're not courageous. You can't be loving if you're not courageous. You cannot be trusting if you're not courageous. You cannot inquire into reality if you're not courageous. Hence, courage comes first and everything else follows. And that's basically what David Hawkins said, that courage is a crucial gateway to higher states of consciousness, according to his model. So when you're below the consciousness level of 200, so it's on a scale of 1 to 1,000, and 200 is a really critical number. When you're below the consciousness level of 200, it means you live primarily in a state of anger, fear, shame, guilt, desire, apathy, which is related to depression. And I'm really pointing out primarily. So being afraid for a moment because you're in a real danger does not mean that's your state of consciousness. We're talking about a baseline way of relating to reality.
Yeah.
And some of the aspects of being below 200 on his map of consciousness, according to him, are being ruled by Your left brain living in a state of stress, adrenaline, fight, flight. You are also ruled by your emotions and wants. So people can also hijack that and use your emotions against you. You tend to blame others. You're more aggressive or passive aggressive, reactive. You primarily seek pleasure and are motivated by physical and emotional survival. So basically in his book, Power Versus Force, force is below 200. So the more that you're blaming others and you're aggressive and passive aggressive and you're motivated by physical and emotional survival, you only have power through force. And this is kind of what I see in this kind of these cancel mobs, is they're trying to force people to do things.
They force their opinion, force you to admit, force you to apologize, force you to have an opinion.
Yes. And then, you know, on the contrary, when you're in a state above 200, you have right brain dominance, you experience more peace, more positive endorphins, more positive emotions, you have an attitude of growth, and you're ruled by reason and inspiration. You take responsibility rather than blame others. You're disciplined, creative, and rather than being focused on physical and emotional survival, you're focused on intellectual development and the fulfillment of your potential. So, you know, when you're focused on survival in this below 200, physical and emotional survival, you will bow to the mob, actually. So courage is a critical step. And courage doesn't mean that you don't feel fear. It means that you feel fear and you do it anyway because you're focused on the fulfillment of your potential and your own development rather than just your survival. So if you're only focused on survival, emotional or physical, when these mobs pile onto you, you will go into fight or flight and a part of you will freak out. But courage is like, okay, I'm afraid, but I'm still going to do the thing that is in alignment with my own growth, alignment with my own potential, you know, rather than just being focused on approval from others. And just to kind of follow up on that, below 200, here's some emotional attitudes he outlined. So being guarded, cynical, suspicious, rude, condemning, focused on self, driven by envy, you tend towards extremes, you are calculating, devious, ungrateful. So it's very interesting because, you know, David Hawkins wrote something very controversial in his book, Truth Versus Falsehood, where he really talked about the dangers of cultural Marxism, the dangers of cultural relativism, and he also calibrated Marx's theories. And what he said about Marx's theories is that they're basically an expression of envy, which is what we've seen. You know, so a lot of these kind of cultural movements are actually being driven by this force, by this negative contractive energy field below 200. And above 200, you're friendly, charitable, trusting, optimistic, forthright, polite and gracious, appreciative. Instead of being concerned for yourself, you're concerned for others and the world. Instead of envy, you have appreciation and respect for others, and you can be honest and truthful, and you can also have a sense of humor with it.
By the way,
truth, he really says that you cannot like enter this 200 and above state without being truthful. You have to be truthful.
I just want to add here, because it says over 200 says, instead of being concerned for yourself, you're concerned for other and the world. And people say, well, I'm concerned not about myself, but for Palestine. No. Your unconsciously actually, it's all about you and your views.
Yes.
Right? It's not about others, actually. You're actually projecting your virtue signaling. You're externalizing. You're projecting your own shadow. You don't know yourself. And I can put the mirror right on myself because I've done exactly the same. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right? Because there's a different state. You can still be speaking out against your trustees in the world, but from a higher state of consciousness without imposing your views on others or needing others to tell them that they need to speak out as well.
Forcing others to do the same. And I've even seen in these cancel storms recently where someone mentioned, hey, this reminds me of Mao's struggle sessions. And in the comments, people were like, let's bring back Mao's struggle sessions.
Wow.
Like the mob justice and the kind of almost like bloodthirsty energy behind them is like an egregore, a thought form in its own that takes you over, right? So, you know, this is why, you know, especially totalitarianism and Carl Jung even warned about the danger of this mass psychosis that happens in crowds.
Yes.
Where you really just hook into this group energy and then you start enacting cruelty against people who maybe otherwise you wouldn't. Like, I even saw people struggle with some of the people who were kind of being canceled in these storms, were like, wow, I actually really appreciate what they had to say. And I'm pretty sure they did share certain things, you know, but if I have to do this to decolonize the world, I guess I will. Like, they were struggling to act out this own egregore, to act out, you know, in the way that the party or the ideology wanted them to, against their conscience, and still acted against it. And it's very, you know, and it's very hard to be on the end of this, but, you know, this courage is really essential. And he really explains, David Hawkins, how spiritual practice can be one of the primary ways you can raise your consciousness. So if you're fundamentally in guilt or shame a lot of the time, and the kind of, bottom level of the scale of consciousness, it's really important that you actually work through those emotions. So you go from these kind of, the lower end of the emotional spectrum, and you raise yourself up higher. And one of these fundamental practices he said was this letting go practice, where, you know, and I do this actually. So there's no situation which is not insurmountable if you know how to deal with the emotions that come up with it. So I post things that people find to be controversial all the time. I'm just also speaking my mind, you know, I'm not doing it in a harsh way. I'm not trying to hurt people, but people will always find a problem with things I post. And, you know, if you can be with the emotion that comes up with full presence, then it's not so scary anymore. So actually, we're not so scared of being, I mean, we are scared of being canceled, but we're more scared of the emotions that come up, which makes us then avoid doing things that will create that emotional reaction, right? So the fundamental practice that he mentioned, which I do all the time, is called the letting go practice, where when you feel something uncomfortable, you have the presence and space to breathe into that feeling, to allow yourself to feel it with full acceptance, and then let it go.
Perfect. Excellent. Thank you so much. And also, we've talked about David Hawkins' work before. I know Laura posted about before, and I've seen with it come a lot of misconceptions, distortions, and projections, misunderstanding of this map of consciousness. So who wants to learn more about it, I highly recommend reading David Hawkins' book, Power versus Force, and his book, Truth versus Falsehood.
Yeah, Power versus Force is more good about the kind of overall map. And just to kind of underline, your inner work and critical thinking can really help you in these instances. So your inner work will help you deal with the emotions that come up. You can do shadow work. You can work with your triggers. You know, we have plenty of podcasts where we talk about that. Being able to, you know, one big question I ask myself when I'm triggered, so someone's canceling me or I have this Twitter storm, like, what does this remind me of? When have I felt this way before? And then that usually backtracks into my own personal history, and then I can work with that material. So your inner work will help you deal with the emotional side of it. So if you're a sensitive person like I am, the inner work helps you process those emotions. And then that helps you take it less personally too. Because keep in mind, this is not personal actually. It's more about this ideology hooking into people and making them enact this against others. And then critical thinking can also help you, because most of the things that I get when I'm on the receiving end of these kind of cancel mobs, you know, they're claiming things that I said that I never even said to begin with. So you need to understand various logical fallacies, especially the straw man argument, where you say one thing and then people construct it to mean something entirely different. We'll talk about in the second hour how you can have difficult conversations with people like this. But if you're not clear about what you said, and you're not clear about how the way that that's going to be distorted through various perceptual filters in other people, then you're going to buy into their own story that they've attached to you. So your own inner work will help you with the emotional piece. But critical thinking is really essential, because a lot of the things that they're going to say about you, if you are on the receiving end of these kind of canceling experiences, are things that you didn't actually say. And you have to be strong enough and clear enough in your own mind to be like, this is what I said, and that's what how you interpreted it, but it's not actually what I meant. And most of all, you need to really be brave and teach it, use it as a lesson in resilience. If you're dealing with major trauma and you're dysregulated all the time, and you know, you're living in a state of fear or depression or exhaustion, you know, maybe you need to take some time out and take care of yourself. I have to say, though, also this culture of like social ostracization and canceling is also creating a lot of fear in people. So sometimes they actually start to feel better when they do an activating movement, when they speak up, when they finally share something. Emotional regulation is key, especially anger, learning how to channel your anger appropriately, learning how to deal with your anger, learning how to handle from anger from others. And lastly, having examples of other people who speak out can help you. So, you know, I see people who are like scared to speak out because they're therapists. You know, there are therapists, like even this therapist we played a clip by, this woman, Some Therapist podcast, who are speaking out. So if you have other examples of people who are doing the same, it will help you because they're working through social ostracization, right? But if you see other people doing it, it will also help you feel not alone and give you that support system.
Yeah. Thank you so much. These are great insights and suggestions, but also not really understanding them. Observe yourself. The moment you cancel yourself, you censor yourself, you're afraid to speak out, you not only support an agenda that's anti-human, that's anti-divine, but you're also going, you're betraying yourself, you're betraying your own soul. You're not living an authentic life. You're not being authentic. So that ties into previous podcast episode number 130. You can check out if you haven't listened to it yet, how to live a more authentic life. And again, if you want to learn more about our view, in-depth view about Israel-Palestine, we have an episode called Israel-Palestine and War, a Psycho-Spiritual and Occult Perspective, episode number 118. Now, for members, we dive deep in the second hour and really want to look at from an esoteric occult perspective, how cancel culture links into totalitarianism and ideologies, tying into the concept of wetiko, entity possession, thought form, hive mind entities, egregores. And we also share some personal stories about how we've been dealing with this. And Laura will also go deep into the astrology with Pluto and Capricorn, how this relates to totalitarianism on both sides, left and right, and to the various Pluto generations coming of age and so forth. So if you're not a member yet, you can go to my website, veilofreality.com/membership and sign up there. And you will have access of over 120 episodes as well. And we'll be right back. Thank you for listening.